This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. President Trump promised that this week would be all about infrastructure. House Republicans advanced a bill to reduce bank regulations. A government contractor was charged with leaking documents about Russian election meddling. And Mr. Trump picked a fight with the mayor of London. But the biggest drama came yesterday in a Senate committee hearing that turned into must-see TV. Former FBI Director James Comey spent 2.5 hours testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee. He said, in part, quote, "Although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI, by saying the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple," unquote. We'll spend most of today's Friday News Roundup exploring what we learned from Comey's explosive testimony and the fallout in Washington. Joining us today in Chapel Hill is Jeff Tiberi, the Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC North Carolina Public Radio. Jeff, welcome to 1A.
Great to be here.
Mandy Locke is an investigative reporter with the News and Observer in Raleigh. Mandy, welcome.
Great to be here.
And to mix things up a bit, we're pleased to welcome a scholar alongside the reporters, Professor Mary Rose Papandrea of the University of North Carolina School of Law. Professor Papandrea, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
We will take some questions about James Comey from our audience here at the Friday Center at UNC Chapel Hill and from you listening wherever you are. So feel free to send us your questions and thoughts about the week's top national stories. And we all know what the top story was. Email us 1A@WAMU.org. Comments on our Facebook page. Tweet us at 1A. You can also watch the live stream of this hour on our Facebook page. And we will begin our conversation, of course, with James Comey. One of the very first things to come up in the hearing was the Russia investigation. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr had the first 12 minutes of questions, and he got to the point asking if Mr. Comey had any doubt that Russia attempted to interfere in the elections, and James Comey said none. He made it very clear he had absolutely no doubt. Professor Mary Rose Papandrea, let me start with you. Why do you believe James Comey is so certain on this?
I imagine he's seen a lot of documents that tell him that this has happened. And I think that is one of the biggest things we should take out of the hearing yesterday, that no matter what, we have a very serious investigation going on in this country, that a foreign country, Russia, one of our great historical enemies, is attempting and may have successfully interfered in some way with our election. This is a very serious thing. The obstruction of justice issue, also important, should not cloud that. No matter where you come down on this issue of what Trump did or didn't do, we need to figure out what's going on with Russia and we need to stop it.
So you got the sense from what Mr. Comey said at yesterday's hearing that he was speaking from knowledge, not just, well, I believe that this is what's going on, but he was relating what he had seen based on the investigation, the paper trail, and so on.
It appears so. He was FBI director until relatively recently, and this investigation has been going on for some time. So I think we all should have reason to believe he's speaking from inside knowledge.
Kind of to that point, Jeff Tiberi, talk about what this might mean going forward. Depending on who you talk to and on which political side you are and what your interests were, everyone seemed to call this a win for whatever side they were on. What do you think is the political currency of this going forward? Did any minds get changed?
That's a good question, and I would say very few, if any, minds got changed yesterday. And it's important to remember that with Republican majorities, and there's no smoking gun, there was nothing that emerged yesterday, at least from my perspective, that was some brand new revelation or something that puts this on a fast track toward a different result. I think that what we heard yesterday was much of what we knew. I mean, there was some new corroboration, but moving forward, I would be surprised if this opens up some impeachment hearing or impeachment proceedings, right? We don't have anything at this point, I don't think, that is brand new and that's going to send this down a different path.
Well, let's get into what was discussed yesterday. Mr. Comey mostly talked about 9 conversations he had had with President Trump over the course of 4 months. Mandy Locke, for those who skipped out on yesterday's hearing, talk to us about what Mr. Comey said those conversations involved. He said it sounded like he said there was a lot of pressure coming from the president.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded like this cloak and dagger experience, not this, you know, what I imagined to be some sort of formalized process of convening a meeting, calling people, bringing your secretary, having your assistant arrange it. It sounded like these sort of meeting in the parking garage types of conversations. But what he described is a very sort of mysterious, sometimes loaded and leading questions, a lot of innuendo, a lot of facial expressions or lack of facial expressions. You know, Comey, in his written statement, took pains to say that at one point when Trump was asking him for some loyalty, he sat rigidly. He refused to blink his eyes, to make any sort of remarks facial, to give him any indication that he was responding or denying or anything. And that is pretty extraordinary.
Did you get the sense, Mandy, that any of these conversations particularly bothered Mr. Comey? Were there certain conversations that he highlighted more than others, or was it just kind of the general mainstream of all those conversations that he referenced?
I mean, it's clear that he had discomfort from the first moment when he went to Trump Tower, had that meeting with President Trump. He clearly, in that moment, realized something was not quite right about that interaction and began commemorating all of those conversations that he had, interactions he had with Trump from that moment forward. So I think that's pretty extraordinary.
Now, a number of senators who were part of the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, mostly conservative, but some not, pressed Mr. Comey repeatedly about why he did not push back against President Trump if he thought the president's conduct was so inappropriate. He told California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein he was so stunned by it that the only thing, that he really wasn't sure what to say. He also responded to the president's tweet threatening that there might be tapes by saying, "Lordy, I hope there are tapes," and saying other people might have been stronger in that circumstance, but he conducted himself the way he did, and hopefully he will never have to deal with that one more time. Mary Rose Papandrea, is this a valid rationale, you think, for Comey's not taking stronger action sooner? How do you think that played during the hearing?
Well, there were a few issues that came up as far as what did Comey do and what didn't he do. So one issue was, how did he react to President Trump when Trump allegedly said the kinds of things that he said? For example, Flynn is a good guy and I hope you can let this go. Should he have pointed out to President Trump, "This is highly inappropriate, President Trump. We can't be having this conversation. I need to run away now." So, you know, perhaps he should have. And I thought he was very honest yesterday. He said, "You know, I'm not Captain Courageous." And I think any of us could put ourselves in that. I thought it was very credible. That's my view. People could take a different view, that when confronted with this highly unusual behavior from a sitting president, that he was somewhat stunned and didn't quite know what to do. So it didn't surprise me. Another issue that came up yesterday was what did Comey do as far as letting Attorney General Sessions and other leaders in DOJ know about this inappropriate, what he viewed as inappropriate communications between the White House and the FBI. And there is some debate whether he behaved properly there, what he told Sessions, what Sessions said in response. And so I think that's something we'll have to sort out as things go forward. I did want to add, in response to something Jeff said earlier, this is just the beginning. Maybe this won't lead to impeachment. We have a Congress that is controlled by Republicans, so that alone suggests that it's unlikely, or at least it would take a very long time. But this investigation by the special counsel is just starting. And so yesterday was just the beginning, not the end. So I think we're going to learn a lot more about what was said to whom and when. And we'll have to see. This is not going to go away. I think that I took that away from yesterday's hearing.
That's UNC Professor Mary Rose Papandrea with us on the Friday News Roundup, alongside Jeff Tiberi, the Capitol Bureau Chief from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio, Mandy Locke, an investigative reporter at the News and Observer, and with you. Share your questions and thoughts about James Comey's testimony. Did you watch? Was there a drinking game involved? Did you go on with your life? Was there anything about the hearing that makes sense? Or do you have questions about about what this all means, or maybe a specific question about something you heard during the hearing, a question-answer exchange that you would like us to try to dig into a little bit more deeply. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. We have to break in a few minutes, but Jeff Tiberi, I wonder about that point that Professor Papandrea brought up in terms of dealing with other officials in the Justice Department hierarchy. Mr. Comey said he got so uncomfortable around President Trump that he told Attorney General Jeff Sessions not to leave the two of them alone in a room. How did that play?
This is awkward, right? I mean, this is unprecedented stuff right here. And it was fitting. I believe it was the New York Times, maybe the Wall Street Journal yesterday, that noted this was the 140th day of the administration, which of course coincides with the number of characters in a tweet. So some weird irony on that front. But to that point, this is only 140 days in, and this is where things stand now. So I absolutely agree. There's much more to be learned. There are going to be new developments here. And for Comey to make that request, to ask the Attorney General not to leave him alone with the president, is just unheard of. But that word, unprecedented, is really, you know, one of the threads that is tying so much of this together.
Mandy, what do you think, briefly, before we go to break?
Yeah, I mean, you know, as much as we would like to expect some decorum, I think that what this showed is that this, you know, everything that played out, it feels very familiar to those of us who went to high school or, remember of a sorority. And so I just think, I mean, that it was just kind of a really entertaining, you know, like a telenovela, except nobody spoke Spanish. So it was just, it was really, really interesting to watch.
I believe we're up against a break. We're going to pause for just a minute, catch our breath, and continue our conversation on the other side as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Mandy Locke of the News and Observer, UNC Law Professor Mary Rose Papandrea, and WUNC's Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff Tiberi. I'm Joshua Johnson, spending the day in beautiful Chapel Hill, North Carolina. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Chapel Hill, North Carolina today for the Friday News Roundup, joined by Jeff Tiberi, the Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC North Carolina Public Radio, Mandy Locke, an investigative reporter for the News and Observer, and UNC Chapel Hill Law Professor Mary Rose Papandrea. We'd love to hear from you too. Share your questions and thoughts about the week's top national news. Comment on our Facebook page. You can also watch our video stream there. Tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's continue our conversation about James Comey's testimony and the fallout thereof. President Trump waited nearly 24 hours to respond to the hearing. He finally tweeted around 6 this morning, writing, quote, "Despite so many false statements and lies, total and complete vindication, and wow, Comey is a leaker," unquote. Mandy Locke, what do you make of the president's tweet?
I mean, I think it speaks for itself.
Okay, Jeff, what do you make of the president? Leave me hanging, I'll throw it back at you. I mean, a lot of people believe that the president would be hot and heavy tweeting, like live tweeting the hearing, and then that did not happen.
Did they lock him up somewhere?
I don't know.
Well, they put him on the ninth tee.
They
got him to a golf course.
Yep.
Well, and I think that was, you know, part of the strategy, I believe, the legal strategy, since he has now retained a personal attorney, was to not put out any more fodder for the president's political or legal adversaries to use against him. Does that make sense to you, Professor?
It certainly makes sense that he finally listens to a lawyer. That is a very good idea. He's gotten himself in a lot of trouble in many areas by speaking freely on Twitter and to the news. For example, here, in this context, he spoke to NBC News and told NBC that he fired Comey because of the Russian investigation. That was unwise. He has made some unfortunate comments about his immigration or recent immigration order, which is also tying his lawyers in knots to try to explain that there was an animus against Muslims, based on kinds of things he says, which indicate that there was animus against Muslims.
You're talking about the recent tweet where he called it a travel ban.
Yes. So yes, I think it's a very good idea. He has lawyers, and that perhaps he's listening to them as a lawyer. I think that's a good idea.
Now that's, go ahead, Jeff. Well,
and it's fitting in some ways, isn't it? Because at every turn, there's been another bombshell, there's been another seemingly inappropriate comment. In preparation for the Comey hearing, there was a drinking establishment, a bar in D.C., that was offering a free round for every tweet that Trump served up during this hearing. So of course he would go silent at this point, when we're all expecting him.
When we're all thirsty.
Now, he may have gone silent, but that's not to say that other Republicans did not do some talking for him. Donald Trump Jr. did live tweet the proceedings. Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told White House reporters that the president is, in her words, quote, definitely not a liar, unquote. And during his weekly press conference, which was smaller than usual because everyone in D.C. was watching James Comey testify, House Speaker Paul Ryan basically told everyone to just lay off.
The president's new at this. He's new to government, and so he probably wasn't steeped in the long-running protocols that establish the relationships between DOJ, FBI, and White Houses. He's just new to this.
That was House Speaker Paul Ryan speaking yesterday. How do we think Paul Ryan's explanation kind of played out? Part of the president's appeal to his base is that he is a Washington newcomer, that he's not an insider, so maybe this just kind of comes with the territory of electing a newcomer.
I think Jeff? To some extent, it signals the slow pace with which this is going to develop, right? I mean, a lot of parallels have been drawn to the Nixon administration. And with Trump, I think that what we're seeing is still a lot of party loyalty, a lot of Republicans who are continuing to stand and back him. Sure, government's very complicated, and there are many things that President Trump still has to learn, is learning as he goes. But at this point, to me, hearing that from Speaker Ryan signals that Speaker Ryan is representing the caucus remains firmly behind the president.
I mean,
Go ahead, Mandy, and then we'll get to your professor.
Anyone who has become president has never been president before, so there is a learning curve that anyone would expect one to have. It is why you have advisors, many who have worked for government for a very long time, who might understand and appreciate the dynamics and communication channels that exist in Washington.
Let's get to a few questions from our audience, and while we begin with the first question, I'll remind you, you can send us your questions wherever you are, no matter how close or far you are from beautiful North Carolina. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin here at the Friday Center at UNC Chapel Hill with Kakoli. Kakoli, would you just tell us where you're from and what's on your mind?
I'm from Cary, North Carolina.
Lovely. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hearing James Comey yesterday, what first came to my mind was, how much weight will James Comey's testimony have? Is it enough to start proceeding towards impeachment?
Good question. Professor Papandrea, can you take a stab at that one? How much weight does this testimony have?
Sure. I've been reading a lot of commentators, and people come down on both sides whether his testimony does provide enough evidence for an obstruction of justice charge, criminal charge, or to support impeachment proceedings based on obstruction of justice. I think there's enough there for a prima facie case of obstruction of justice. As I mentioned earlier, I thought Comey came across as quite credible, and as Comey himself was asked at the hearing, a lot of this does come down to credibility.
I'm sorry, Professor, for those who aren't steeped in legalese, prima facie case?
Oh, I'm sorry. enough of a case for an indictment or enough to pass the laugh test, like this is a serious matter.
Gotcha.
And so I think that there is enough based on the facts and circumstances, the total circumstances that Comey presented yesterday that suggest obstruction of justice. It may not be enough to bring it across the finish line, but again, as I mentioned earlier, it really will, impeachment proceedings will depend on the political will of Congress, and that remains to be seen.
And
I think we're far from that now.
And certainly Mr. Comey made the point that this was a very serious matter. He said as much toward the end of the hearing.
The reason this is such a big deal is we have this big, messy, wonderful country where we fight with each other all the time, but nobody tells us what to think, what to fight about, what to vote for, except other Americans. And that's wonderful and often painful, but we're talking about a foreign government that, using technical intrusion and lots of other methods, tried to shape the way we think, we vote, we act. That is a big deal.
That was James Comey near the end of yesterday's testimony. Let's keep going now with a question from D. O'Brien, who tweeted, "Let's say Trump gets impeached for whatever. Can't his successor, presumably Vice President Mike Pence, pardon any and every conceivable crime? Professor, is that how the law works?"
I'm sorry.
I'll ask it again. Suppose Trump gets impeached for whatever. Can't his successor, presumably Vice President Mike Pence, pardon every and any conceivable crime?
Yeah, there's no limit to the pardon power.
So that's certainly conceivable.
Yes.
Although I think it's worth noting that impeachment is a two-step process.
Well, right. I mean, impeachment's not a technically not a crime, so it wouldn't. He still would not be president anymore. So. I'm not sure I understand the question.
You mentioned an indictment before. Where do you think is the most viable path? Where would that come from?
The indictment?
Yeah, reasonably speaking. I mean, where might, if it passed that initial challenge, so to speak, that you mentioned?
I don't think right now, this is a great question to make sure we all understand. Right now, it is unlikely there would be a criminal proceeding brought against a sitting president. The Department of Justice's own manual suggests that there cannot be a criminal proceeding against a sitting president. So we are not likely to see a criminal proceeding at this point. He would have to be out of office first. At that point, then it could be an office, the U.S. Attorney's office in the District of Columbia, most likely.
This gets to some of those constitutional questions about the nature of the presidency that began to come up early in this whole scandal about the president's immunity, which the Constitution gives the president wide immunity in a lot of matters, just for the sake of being able to govern the country.
Right. To be full in my explanation, there are people out there who think that the president is not actually entitled to immunity from criminal prosecution right now while he's in office. But that seems to be the governing or the predominant view that a sitting president cannot be charged criminally. But there is some debate about that.
Jonathan tweeted, "What was the panel's take on Senator John McCain's line of questioning? Confused, trying to prompt a specific response, or on point? Senator McCain was making references to the investigation into Hillary Clinton and trying to draw a parallel there that I think left a lot of people walking away kind of confused. But what was your reaction to Senator McCain's line of questioning? Jeff?"
I would use the word wacky. It seemed a little wacky to me. But in all seriousness, it seemed odd. The path he was going down certainly seemed odd to me. I guess that is concisely how I would summarize it.
Mandy?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, in my newsroom yesterday, as that was happening, you know, we had reporters standing in front of the TVs. We had reporters listening with their headphones. And then you could hear this collective, "What?" And so I think it was really kind of confusing, and there was concern. You know, what was in his mind?
I would all add one note, and on the flip side of it, perhaps because Comey was so stoic for so much of yesterday, maybe this was a senator for how long? 36 years now in the U.S. Senate. He was trying to throw Comey off his game. Maybe he was just trying to kind of break the ice.
Strategy.
And Senator McCain did release a statement.
Yeah.
It could be strategic. Senator McCain did release a statement later in the day joking that, quote, "maybe going forward I shouldn't stay up late watching Diamondbacks night games."
Ah.
So maybe it was just a late night. He went on to say, "What I was trying to get at was whether Mr. Comey believes that any of his interactions with the president rise to the level of obstruction of justice. In the case of Secretary Clinton's emails, Mr. Comey was willing to step beyond his role as an investigator and state his belief about what no reasonable prosecutor would conclude about the evidence. I wanted Mr. Comey to apply the same approach to the key question surrounding his interactions with President Trump, whether or not the president's conduct constitutes obstruction of justice." Professor, does that sound like a logical parallel to you?
Well, I think he was trying to make sense of a question that didn't make a lot of sense. But yeah, I mean, the idea was, you know, Comey, you made a big deal about Hillary Clinton not having violated the laws on the handling of her email. Why can't you just come out and say something similar about President Trump? And Comey has said, well, there was a whole investigation with Clinton that he explained why, subsequently why he felt that he could say those things about Clinton. I was wondering whether the statement, although Senator McCain's questions, although convoluted, were an attempt that we didn't see a lot yesterday, frankly, of trying to undermine Comey a little bit, bringing up the whole Clinton email, the way he handled the Clinton email controversy. I thought it was quite remarkable yesterday that most senators, even those who were hostile to Comey, didn't really attack his credibility as much. You may have noticed so many of them said, thank you for your service and all of that. So it was a different kind of tone.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. We'll get to another question from the audience in just a moment from Kimberly. Kimberly, we'll come to your question in just a second, but I do want to get your reaction to another cut from James Comey's testimony. At one point, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia asked Mr. Comey why he decided to record all of his meetings with President Trump. Here's what Mr. Comey said.
A combination of things. I think the circumstances, the subject matter, and the person I was interacting with. Circumstances first, I was alone with the President of the United States, or the President-elect, soon to be President. The subject matter, I was talking about matters that touch on the FBI's core responsibility and that relate to the President, President-elect personally. And then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document. That combination of things I'd never experienced before, but it led me to believe I got to write it down, and I got to write it down in a very detailed way.
That's James Comey responding to questions about why he took such copious recordings about his meetings with the president. Professor Papandrea, how common is that? That sounds like a rather extraordinary step to take,
well,
but
he,
is it?
By his own admission, Comey said that was a very unusual thing. He did not take notes of meetings he had with prior presidents. But as Jeff was saying earlier, Comey felt sufficiently uncomfortable. This is a massive violation of the norms and customs that govern the interaction between the FBI and the White House. And it clearly bothered Comey, and it clearly caused him a lot of concern that that in a swearing match, he might lose against the president. So he felt it was important to write down contemporaneous notes of his interactions.
Kimberly from Durham has been waiting patiently to get a question. And Kimberly, what's on your mind?
Hi. My question is there any way election results could be thrown out? If it's found the Trump campaign colluded, would SCOTUS hear the case?
Professor, what do you think? It seems like a tall order to me, but
what
do you
think? Yeah, of course, totally unprecedented. I don't think that could happen, but you can imagine a lot of legal scholars would be hard at work to figure out how to do that. But I can't point to any cause of action directly. It would be tricky, but people would be working hard to figure out how to do that.
You know, Jeff and Mandy, I can't help but think that this certainly bolsters the argument in a way that all of this makes it impossible to get governance done. I mean, the president argues that he can't get his agenda through because there's this Russia investigation and we need to resolve this so that we can move on with other matters. But it seems like as long as the conversation has these questions within it, that the nation is kind of stuck in this weird governmental limbo that we got to deal with before we can keep moving.
And as we started the program and you mentioned, did anybody have their mind altered or changed yesterday? And I said, I don't think so, or at least not very many people. Joshua, you and I had a conversation yesterday and you mentioned the dirty word of Washington, the C word, compromise. And it feels like in this hyper-partisan time, we are further and further away from that. And that's how you govern. That's how with 435 members of the U.S. House and a country that is increasingly diverse, that's how you get things done, and it seems like we are just drifting further and further away from that.
One more question before we hit a break. Stephanie tweeted, Comey is an investigator. Wouldn't he naturally treat everything as potential evidence?
You mean as far as his conversations with, I'm not sure.
I suppose so. I mean, there's this, it was extraordinary to me that Mr. Comey was the one who leaked the document.
About the leaks.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yes. Well, I think as far as the leaking, that is fascinating. People may not realize this, but Comey himself has been vociferously opposed to leakers and has argued strongly for leak prosecutions, and now he himself is leaking. I think there's not likely that he could be charged with leaking. There is no broad crime against leaking anything that's confidential. But I think he wanted to make sure he protected himself and he got his side of the story out, which is a motivation for many other leakers. So I thought that was very telling. He's had a full circle evolution on his views towards leaks, apparently.
We're up against a break, but there is one more question about this I'd like us to get to on the other side of the break. Dave emailed us, there seemed to be numerous times Mr. Comey couldn't respond in the open public hearing. Wouldn't the more serious testimony be in the classified closed hearings with the committee and the ongoing Mueller investigation? Think on that. We're going to take a quick break and we'll talk about that. And then we will pivot to another big story, a hot North Carolina issue that is having serious national repercussions. As we continue our conversation with UNC's Professor Mary Rose Papandrea, Jeff Tiberi of WUNC, and Mandy Locke of the News and Observer. And with you. Stay close. Before we get back to the roundup, we would love your help with Monday's program on the fight for LGBT equality. Monday marks 1 year since the deadly mass shooting at Pulse, a gay nightclub in Orlando. The attack and the election of President Trump have led many in the LGBT community to feel they need to refocus their activism. Some say it's time for a return to the kind of direct action seen in the early days of the modern gay rights movement. How are you seeing LGBT activism change these days? Is it reflecting the movement's early days? Maybe where you are, it's more focused on political influence and lobbying. Or perhaps you're seeing the most progress being made online, using social media to produce tangible changes. For that matter, is it changing enough? Or at all? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A, and press option 2. How are you seeing LGBT activism change these days? Tell us your story, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and press option 2. You can also record yourself and email the audio file to 1A@WAMU.org. We'll talk about LGBT activism today and share some of your stories Monday on 1A. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Jeff Tiberi of WUNC North Carolina Public Radio, Mandy Locke of the News and Observer in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Mary Rose Papandrea, law professor at UNC. Dave emailed us, concerning the Comey hearing, there seemed to be numerous times Mr. Comey couldn't respond in the open public hearing. Wouldn't the more serious testimony be in the classified closed hearings with the committee and the ongoing Mueller investigation? Professor, what do you think?
Sure. There's certainly going to be some more information coming out to the senators in those closed hearings. I thought there was a lot revealed in yesterday's hearing, but there were multiple times when Comey said he couldn't speak, and we'll learn, we may not learn, but the senators are going to be asking some tough questions about what did Senator Sessions, what information they had about Senator Sessions' involvement with Russia. Comey alluded to that, and other things that where Comey demurred yesterday.
I wonder maybe, Jeff Tiberi, to Dave's question, how much this open hearing feels just like political theater. I mean, there is the public investigation that we all get to see, and then there's this closed-door investigation that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, is doing, and we may not hear anything from that. If he doesn't see a need to file charges, the investigation could just end, and that would be the end of it. Are we getting hooked on the political theater of all this a little bit too much?
Definitely a little bit. I don't know if a little bit too much. I'm reminded of the line, I think it's in Independence Day, what the American public doesn't know is what makes them the American public. not to sound too cynical and
I don't know how I feel about that with myself. But I do take your point, that it seems like the theater of this is just easier to follow. It's a simple soap opera.
Yeah, and there's much more that the Senate Intelligence Committee knows than what we heard yesterday, or that they're going to learn and that they will learn, yes.
I think Comey was very careful not to intrude upon the investigation. I thought he was very cautious, so that many times when he said he would not talk about certain things, he was trying to protect the integrity of the investigation.
Mandy?
You know, but as it relates to the substance of the Russia investigation, we in North Carolina, there was a convention for Republicans in our state a week or two ago in Wilmington, and the collective response by the players in the Republican Party is that they're over this Russia thing. And it really hasn't begun. And what is going to be revealed, I think there's a disconnect between voters' appetite to think on this, to consider it, to study it, and close it.
And there's also the matter of the fact that there are a number of very big issues before Congress right now, including the next budget. There is the Republican plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act that dovetails into the budget, that dovetails into the tax reform plan. And the timing for all of this really matters. If one piece falls out, the whole thing could fall apart. So, you know, there may be something to that idea that, like, we have government to do. We've got things that we have to get done.
Not only an agenda, but also President Trump filling out his administration, making
right.
judicial appointments, doing all these things that a president normally does without much fanfare. This has bogged that down and slowed really the whole process of government down, big and small ticket items.
Speaking of theater and fanfare,
hello.
Can we bring it a little closer to home, North Carolina?
Sure.
Despite the wall-to-wall coverage of James Comey's testimony, other things did happen in the news this week. And one of the biggest stories that didn't get a whole lot of coverage, but that we want to put some attention on, is unfolding here in North Carolina. The U.S. Supreme Court found that this state tried to dilute the voting power of African Americans. Justices affirmed a lower court ruling that found racial gerrymandering in 28 North Carolina districts. It was the state's third voting rights case before the Supreme Court in the past 3 weeks. Now, North Carolina's governor, Roy Cooper, is a Democrat. The legislature is mostly Republican. This week, lawmakers rejected Governor Cooper's appeal for a special session to redraw the state's political maps. Mandy, how are the maps drawn currently? What was it that the Supreme Court took issue with?
So the Supreme Court found that the map as drawn diluted the power of particularly our black voters in North Carolina to cast votes and elect people that actually reflected their choices and their districts.
I know every state draws maps a little bit differently. Does North Carolina do it with an independent commission? Do lawmakers draw the maps? Does a computer draw the maps?
Well, I don't draw the maps, and my friend here, Jeff, knows a lot more about the technicalities of that, so I'll punt that to him.
These are computer-drawn maps at this point, but it is the Republican legislature, which has a veto-proof majority in both chambers, that passes the maps. And one of the complaints from Republicans who have drawn these maps is they say because of the Voting Rights Act, because this was what was a pre-clearance state, because North Carolina has to take race into account, they have to look at the black vote, the black population. But what's unclear, this is the Republican standpoint now, they say it's unclear how much to take it into account. And this is an area where they say they've run into trouble. They will contend that there are more African American legislators in the North Carolina House today than there have been since Reconstruction, potentially ever, but in at least 150 years. So they say, how much is too much? What's the definition? What's the equation to considering race? But bigger issue here is that a number of laws that have been passed by the Republican-led General Assembly since 2011 have been thrown out. And this is perhaps fundamentally the biggest one. The governor said this week that the mere existence of the legislature these past 5.5 years has been unconstitutional. So new maps are coming. When is the big question? And there will be either new maps for the 2018 midterm elections, the legislative elections here, or it's slim possibility there could be 2017 special elections.
We do welcome your questions and thoughts, particularly if you are listening from North Carolina about this whole saga, what questions you have about what it means and maybe where it's going from here, or what your perspectives are on this. We welcome those questions as well. We'll probably get back to James Comey just a little bit before the end of the hour, so keep your question. It's the story that won't go away. So keep your questions coming on that. 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page or tweet us at 1A. Professor Mary Rose Papandrea, gerrymandering gets a very bad name. We did a whole show on gerrymandering. There are big critics of gerrymandering. But gerrymandering in and of itself is not inherently illegal, is it?
Yeah, that's correct. In the Supreme Court's decision, the court said it's possible to take race into account. Even racial gerrymandering can be permissible if it's done for good reasons. And here, what the problem was in North Carolina is that districts were redrawn in such a way that actually diluted the vote rather than bolstered the vote. So taking minority, where you had districts where the minority interests were already resulting in the election of representatives that were favorable to the minority interests, you didn't need to redraw the lines in order to increase the success of minority-supported candidates.
But I guess what I'm also getting at is even the act of drawing political lines just to advantage one party or another even that's not entirely, like, that's not inherently illegal either.
Right, that's not, there is a big debate about, is there a point where partisan gerrymandering will itself be unconstitutional, but generally speaking, that is not as problematic as the racial gerrymandering.
Jeff, you mentioned pre-clearance. Can you dig a little bit into that a little more for people who don't follow this, some of the history behind North Carolina and how its voting laws have been treated over time, why this spotlight on North Carolina is significant?
This goes back to the Voting Rights Act of the mid-60s that was signed by President Johnson, and in states, Jim Crow states, in states where there was segregation, if voting laws were going to change, they had to go through the Department of Justice to get pre-clearance, and jump in here if I'm missing any of the beats on this, but they had to get cleared to if they were going to make changes to election law. And what happened in 2013 was there was a Supreme Court case striking down parts of the fourth and fifth sections of the Voting Rights Act, essentially undoing that pre-clearance mandate. And within days, the North Carolina General Assembly passed a law requiring photo identification and reducing early voting and eliminating out-of-precinct balloting and same-day registration. And these are voting tools that the researchers, the experts, I mean, pretty much everybody says are used predominantly by Black and Latino voters. So that is another law, bit of an offshoot here, that has also been passed by this legislature and overturned.
We're low on time for the hour. We do have time for those of you here in the hall with us at the Friday Center. If you do have a question, just raise your hand and we'll bring the mic over to you. We'll get the mic to you in just a moment, sir. But first, let me read in a tweet so that we can get the mic to you. Wizard tweets, what will happen with the districts now? Will new elections be held because the districts were deemed inappropriate? Mandy Locke, do we know what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's a political football that's going on right now. So you've got the governor wanting special elections to take place. You've got the Black Caucus in the legislature wanting that to take place. And then you've got a ton of resistance from the Republican Party. And the Supreme Court decision, unfortunately, left us with the duty to make that decision locally here in North Carolina. So to be determined.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. All right, let's get to a question from our audience. Sir, what's your name and what's on your mind, briefly?
Charlie Vanderhorst from Chapel Hill. Professor, could you comment on one person, one vote, as the Constitution interprets it, as well as in North Carolina, over 50% of North Carolinians voted for Democratic congressional candidates, but fewer than 25% of our congressional representatives are Democratic. Thank you.
Well, that gets back to the permissibility of partisan gerrymandering. And unfortunately or fortunately, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, we don't elect congressional representatives as a state in at-large elections. So the fact that we may be able to find a majority of voters who voting Democrat, we have to look at the districts themselves. And so the only way to attack that is to attack the districts and the way that those districts have been established.
Mandy, Jeff, could I ask you, were there any people, any lawmakers, any kind of players in this case who were defending the current redistricting map or the current redistricting system? Did they make a case for why it's a legitimate way to draw the maps? Or did they just allow the Supreme Court to kind of rip them up and throw them back? Was there ever a case made for the maps?
I mean, their argument against this has been, these are partisan maps, and they are trying to... Republicans were not in control of both chambers for more than a century. So when they got control in 2010, and then the census came, and then they got to draw maps in 2011, they wanted to bolster, and they did, because they got supermajorities the next election, they wanted to bolster that power. This is much more, in their eyes, about power. This is not about, you know, racism or any bigoted, hateful agenda. This is just about, you know, drawing the maps that are most beneficial to their party moving forward.
Political advantage.
Yep.
Basically the way that all gerrymandering happens. Mandy?
You know, it's interesting. I try to avoid going to the legislature as much as possible and stick with the people. And so, on Election Day last year, I had this sort of this serendipitous moment, which is the joy of reporting. I happened to be at a polling place about a mile down the street from Jones Street, where the legislature does what they do. And I hear music, and all of a sudden I look over and I see the St. Augustine's campus marching band coming toward the polling station, followed by the entire student body body of this historically black college, administrators, students, and they all came en masse to cast their votes on Election Day. And what was so striking to me was how much focus the administration had put on helping instill the sense of voting rights, voting obligation, the history of casting a vote, and they didn't really need to look far to see the impact of that, because one of the districts, the line, severed North Carolina A&T, just down the road, another historically black college, it severed their college campus. And so they were able to bring all that together and brought the music, brought the heat, and they clogged up that polling place for 4 hours. And it was the most glorious thing I've seen on an election day ever.
Benjamin tweets, politicians draw the lines that ultimately elect them. Are there other ways to draw the lines? Is anyone talking, Jeff, about a better way to do this?
There are some interesting, there are folks on the right and left who are calling for independent redistricting in North Carolina. One of them, perhaps the most prominent lawmaker, is a Republican in the North Carolina House. This is done in Iowa. Iowa has independent redistricting. Iowa is also far less diverse from an ethnic standpoint than North Carolina. Yes, there's plenty of chatter about it. One theory is that if it's ever going to happen, it's going to happen in a year that ends in a 9. So that if Republicans are in control in 2019 or Democrats in 2029, if they're facing a decade change in a new census and potentially losing control, they'll say, okay, we're pushing it off. We're gonna do the independent thing. But there's chatter, but there's no movement on it.
Before we run out of time this hour, what is the next step in all this? Is there a timeline for moving forward? The special session isn't happening, at least right now. Where does this go from here? Or is it just a stalemate?
There's a three-judge panel in the Fourth Circuit, which is the Carolinas, the Virginias, and Maryland. That three-judge panel, at some point, and we don't know when, could be days, weeks, I would expect in the next month or two, to issue a remedy. And that's a schedule for when the maps have to be passed and when an election would take place. But depending on what they say and who doesn't like it, they can appeal this up to the Supreme Court.
And briefly, any strong grassroots pressure to do something more? Any organizations that are leading the way? Or is this really in the legislature's hands right now?
No, not at this point. I mean, they've made plenty of noise. I mean, I think that at this point, the maps need to be redrawn, and there will be elections with new maps either this year or next year.
All right. Well, we will keep following the North Carolina story. Of course, we'll keep following the James Comey story, or rather, the James Comey story will keep following us. Jeff Tabiri is the Capitol Bureau Chief at WUNC North Carolina Public Radio. Thank you for spending the hour with us, Jeff.
It was a treat.
Mandy Locke is an investigative reporter with the News and Observer in Raleigh. Mandy, thank you.
Thank you.
And Mary Rose Papandrea, constitutional law professor at UNC Chapel Hill. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you.
Remember to send us your stories about what you see in LGBT activism today, 855-236-1A1A, or you can email 1A@wamu.org. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Many thanks to WUNC North Carolina Public Radio for hosting us and the Friday Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.